conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for over 2.5 years shared with KLRB listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and other abuses of power in America. The weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show. It's the most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15.
Good afternoon. Again, Dialogue Conspiracy. This is November 26th. I've lost count. I think this is the 127th week of Dialogue Conspiracy on KLRB. We meet once a week and share the news of the week and how it pertains to past political assassinations. I had a vacation for a week and a half and went to Dayton, Ohio to speak to the university there. Had interesting experience speaking to the students in the afternoon, another group again in the evening. I haven't made any public appearances outside of California, out of our own state, the colleges and high schools, but I did go to Ohio, and it was very worthwhile to meet people in another area and see where their heads are at, see how much they know about conspiracies, how much they care, how much they're willing to listen, see what kind of questions they're asking. The travel hasn't changed since the last trip I took with regard to my work. When I went to New Orleans in 67, when I went to see Jim Garrison down there, this time I used another name. And I figure the Watergate people travel with an alias, and I can do the same thing, but somebody still knows who you are. I used another name for my tickets, and I trust my baggage not to be checked through because it never arrives at the proper place, and it's always gone into, and I've learned not to take my notes or my books with me or reading material except what I put in my hand, so that my luggage, my clothing is on the airplane and the others in my hand. And I checked out of Monterey, and instead of sending everything straight through to Dayton, Ohio, United Airlines, I took it from Monterey to San Francisco and collected it there, and then rechecked it at San Francisco to Chicago, and then picked it up there at the gate, and then went from Chicago and checked it to Dayton. And then when I get into the Dayton airport, we all wait, and there's a thing that goes around and around, and everybody's waiting for their baggage, and people are waiting about 20 or 30 minutes and really restless because a plane has come and is ready to take off to the next place. And the luggage, the wheel goes around and around and there's no luggage. And then I thought my suitcase was coming off. It was a green plaid suitcase. And I reached for it and some woman said, "No, that's my suitcase," because it looked identically to mine. And she looked at hers and said, "Oh, somebody broke into hers." Hers was all, she opened it up just to see the clothing so we could be sure because they looked alike. And we didn't get out the stubs yet to check the numbers. And she said somebody broke into her suitcase. Her things had evidently been rearranged. And then my suitcase came off the circle. And I looked at mine, and the number, the stub that I had matched mine. And when I got to the house where I was staying and took the suitcase upstairs, my lock was torn off. And where the zipper and the lock is, the lock was completely torn off, just ripped off. Hers had gone into because they thought it was mine, evidently, but mine was locked, so they just ripped the lock off. And so when I traveled to the next city, I put rope and string around it just so the thing wouldn't fall open. There was still nothing in there but clothing. It was just the harassment. And then coming home, I was so tired of changing. I was on Western Airlines, and instead of saying, "Okay, send it, you know, I'll take it in San Francisco and again see that it gets on the plane back to Monterey," I checked it straight to Monterey. And again, when I arrive in Monterey, there is no suitcase, just like when I came home from Dallas or New Orleans, and everybody else's luggage checks through, but mine isn't there. And you leave your name at the airport, and it's delivered at my house later in the evening, around 7 or 8 o'clock at night. My suitcase is delivered to my home. could go through my bathrobe or stockings or underwear, whatever they please. There wasn't anything in there, but it's just the idea that somebody knows you're going somewhere and manages. Every time I take a trip, whether it's in San Francisco to do radio shows, the car is broken into and things are taken, or the car is taken apart and things are, you know, damaged in the car, or when I travel, somebody knows where I'm going, and it's a harassment of a kind I don't particularly appreciate. But at least I got there and back, and I'm grateful that I'm still alive. It kept me alive. At first I was going to take the train, but I took the plane. I want to talk about a few subjects that were important in the news this week. And to get into them, I have to refer to the article that I've mentioned several times on the show that was in Esquire magazine this last November. It's the Esquire of November 1973. There was an article called, "Did There Come a Point in Time When There Were 43 Different Theories of How the Watergate Happened?" And it's a tongue-in-cheek, facetious, a half-assed article by Edward J. Epstein and John Barrett, which is not a complete account of the Watergate theories. And it certainly, if you read the article carefully, it can bring up more provocative questions than those people even want you to think about. But they think that if they have a tongue-in-cheek attitude, that people will pass these things off and not take them seriously because there's so many different theories. But my name was mentioned in three of those theories, and they're important because of the news that came out this week. So I want to briefly mention the three where they referred to me and my research and tell you the news that came out in the conjunction this week. One theory which they refer to is the grand scheme, the tip of the iceberg. The proponent is Carl Oglesby, who writes for the Boston Phoenix, Kirk Sale from the New York Review of Books, and Mae Brussel for The Realist, called the Yankees versus the Cowboy theory. And the thesis which they put in there is that the Watergate is merely one episode in a titanic subterranean war between two competing elites known in the underground press as the Yankees and the Cowboys. The Yankees are the Eastern establishment, the old line interests, the Kennedys, Rockefellers, the liberal wing of the CIA, the Council of Foreign Relations, and the Cowboys are Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, the oil tycoons, Howard Hughes, Aristotle, Onassis, Frank Sinatra. And it goes into the fact that since World War II, the Cowboys have been fighting the Yankees for control. And up till 63, the Yankees, through Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, warning of the military-industrial complex, and Kennedy, kept control of the military and the economy. But the Cowboys took over with the assassination of John Kennedy in Dallas. They referred this as the tip of the iceberg theory, and as I say, Carl Oglesby, Kirk Sale, and Mae Brussel were mentioned as the believers in the tip of the iceberg theory. Well, this week, Senator Baker, who's been one of the great apologists on the Senate Select Committee, who covers up Mr. Pretty Boy, who plays very stupid and asks asinine questions that are never pertinent and never really gets to the heart of the matter, who seems to be protecting Richard Nixon and his own self-interest by never having the proper witnesses or the proper questions asked. Even Senator Howard Baker had to admit publicly at a convention in Orlando, Florida, a newspaper convention of 400 newsmen, that the American people have only seen the tip of the iceberg. Now, this is Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee, who's on the Senate Select Committee. He says, "As distasteful as it is to me, it is entirely possible that Watergate will not be over any time soon." He said he still wasn't sure why the Democratic National Headquarters in Washington were burglarized in 1972, or why the burglars broke in the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. "I'm afraid the 100 or so loose ends won't be tied up by the time the committee issues its final report," Baker said. "Because of the unanswered questions, he would recommend the standing Senate committees continue a sweeping public appraisal of the functions of the government and the officials who serve it." And he called on the press to continue your own investigation. Now, that's really a garbled message, because he knows, first of all, he has the articles that I've written, and he knows about Lewis Tackwood, and he knows about William Sullivan of Division 5 and Martha Mitchell. And he knows that there's evidence of planned violence at the conventions down in San Diego first and then moved to Miami. And he's telling you that by the time they write their report on February 28th, they will have nothing more than the tip of the iceberg. And that is exactly the way the Warren Commission worked. They had a date to close their findings, and they didn't go into any of the conspiratorial evidence at all. They killed time until the closing date and then came out with a quotation of Earl Warren's that said, "We may never know the truth in our lifetime." So here is Mr. Baker asking the press to do its own investigation because he doesn't intend to do it, so the press should do their own investigation. And then there should be a public appraisal of the functions of government officials. We already know what their functions are, and they're disobeying them, and they're acting illegally, and they're criminals. So the question is, why are they not arrested? Why aren't they in jail? Why aren't they being questioned? Why are they being protected? So the tip of the iceberg theory that was in Esquire is certainly verified by a member of the Senate Select Committee himself, who's telling you they're not going to tell you more than the tip of the iceberg theory. Esquire had another theory called the American Reich theory, in which the proponents were James McCord and Arthur Schlesinger, Senator George McGovern, Edmund Muskie, William Fulbright, Sam Ervin, and Mae Brussel. And the theory is that Watergate was one manifestation of an attempt to set up a dictatorship. And the selling points in this theory that Esquire mentioned was the similarities between Hitler's Reich and the tactics used by the Nixon administration, the mass arrests in Washington in 1970, the Gestapo harassments, the plan to firebomb the Brookings Institute, which was like the Reichstag fire, the antagonism towards left-wing elements at home. And it gives a list of the reasons why the Watergate group were similar to the rising of the Third Reich in Germany. And then I have my own theory called Murderville theory, and this is the one which they half praise and half make fan of, and I want to illustrate an article from a newspaper from the Washington Post and New York Times this week to show you what fools those men are in Esquire, putting down some serious research. I don't have to defend what I know in my work, but I have to illustrate to you what kind of garbage you're fed so that maybe you can get your head straight. In that theory, the Murderville theory by the proponent of Mae Brussel and Lewis Tackwood, the thesis, which they said is that Watergate is just one visible sign of a gigantic plot by the CIA military-industrial complex to take over the country. And using the information of Tackwood and Glasshouse tapes, they go into the planned violence at the Republican convention and the martial law plan to cancel the elections that I mentioned in my Realist article. The Grand Murderville Conspiracy Theory, this is from Esquire magazine, is relentlessly all-inclusive. It takes in not only the political assassinations, but the death of Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, the Manson slayings, Chappaquiddick, Ted Kennedy wasn't in the car, J. Edgar Hoover's murder, and so forth. And then it goes on to compliment me that I am becoming America's leading conspiracy theorist. In defense of myself, the selling point of this Murderville theory, according to Esquire, was that there wasn't any selling point. And the drawback was that for all of Mae Brussel's conspiracies to be true, more than half the country would have to be in on them, thus making them Democratic. Well, there was a Senate Select Committee, a special closed hearing committee this week in which the subject of the murder of J. Edgar Hoover by the Watergate group was brought up by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Egan under oath, under sworn testimony that the Watergate group were, in fact, in on the murder of J. Edgar Hoover. There was an article to back up this theory that so the New York Times dated November the 15th this last week and the Washington Post, and it said the Italian death list of 1,617 attributed to the rightist plotters. Now, in the book I'm writing, Murderville, USA, I'm going into the murder of between 200 to 300 deaths of judges, lawyers, musicians, actors, civil rights leaders that have been murdered by the right wing in the United States, the same people that did the political assassinations. But in Italy, the same CIA group that worked to overthrow Greece, that planned a military coup d'etat in Italy in 1971 that fell through, that was an abortive coup d'etat, the same group that had achieved the coup in Greece was aborted in 1971, but it has been exposed now that this same Italian group that worked with the Greek military junta, and they also work with our CIA, has in fact in Italy a death list of 1,617 Italians. The membership on it is considered like a political status symbol. The men who planning these assassinations and carrying them out systematically in Italy are doctors and lawyers. The chain of crimes committed so far has been to prepare for a far-right takeover. Now, I'm talking about a situation that has been exposed this last week in Italy that has been working in conjunction with our CIA and the same people that worked in Greece. It's a neo-Nazi group of West Germans. They have a death roll, a list that was found in the home of a man, a physician arrested by the name of Dr. La Spezia. The list includes communists, socialists, and hundreds of prominent left-wing politicians. I mentioned in Germany that in order to take over the German government, there were at least 400 deaths of prominent people that stood in the way, judges and lawyers and newspaper people and writers, that stood in the way of exposing the plans to overthrow the government. Until Hitler finally came into power, the approximate death was 400. The Italian death list right now is 1,617. And when I total up the thing that I'm doing in Murderville now, I think my American deaths, if I were to say they were 1,617, it would be hard to believe when I say there's 200 to 300. Esquire magazine says, well, that's impossible. But in Italy, the interior minister in charge of the police force is one of the men designated on the list to be murdered, because he was considered left of center. Well, what makes it any different to murder their interior minister in charge of police force or whether we murder J. Edgar Hoover for the same purposes? If they do it in Italy, then they do it in America. They even have on the list some right-wing extremists, and that is happening too. Here there are certain people that are catching on to what's happening that have been murdered, that people do not understand that in order to overthrow a country, you take some of your co-workers along with you, like in China, Lin Pao and Mao Tse-tung had it out. And right-wing people can kill other right-wing people. Dorothy Hunt can be murdered. She can be part of their team and be murdered by persons from orders in the White House, too. They don't just take communists. They take people on their own side that know too much. They're co-workers that worked with them, like Jack Ruby in Dallas, Texas, who worked with the team, and he had to be murdered. There are 400 people from Rome that are involved in this, and journalists are on the list. And each person's death list, like the enemy list at the White House that was disclosed recently in our own White House, is a printed form. It's a death sentence with a bill of charges, and then the orders go out. There's a Prince Borghese, B-O-R-G-H-E-S-E, now living in Spain. Prince Borghese, he's 67 years old. He's a World War II hero, and he was the leader of a semi-clandestine rightist group, and he disappeared 2 years ago. But he was part of that abortive coup in 71 that didn't take off, and they now believe he's in Spain. And the secret work that E. Howard Hunt was doing in Spain has never been opened up. There's some secret trips that our White House plumbers were doing. And the Houston plans included political assassinations, that secret government inside the White House. We got a tip of the iceberg of that. So you have a Mr. Prince Borghese working. They believe he's in Spain, and he worked with that abortive coup, but that doesn't mean they won't come back again if they already have their death list of 1,617. So I bring this out because we have our international Nazis and neo-Nazis in the United States moving from New Orleans trademark to England, to France, to Spain, to Italy, Greece, Brazil. They've been a close-knit group since World War II, and the war has come home. I mentioned, I think, before, last week or the week before on the radio program, get the article called The War Comes Home by St. George, a friend of Frank Sturgis's, a man who works in the American Intelligence Agency, who referred to the CIA taking over the FBI and fatally J. Edgar Hoover fatally being done away with in the power struggle. So in this list, there was an article in November about the fatality of J. Edgar Hoover being caught in the squeeze. And then there was this hushed testimony at the hearings. It was regarding Hoffa, and Mr. Egan was talking. Jack Anderson wrote about this last week. It said Egan's credibility dropped farther when he said that the late J. Edgar Hoover was murdered. As his questioners grasped, he went on, "Everyone on hearing his says I'm nuts, but somebody in the Watergate thing murdered J. Edgar Hoover." That was the testimony of a man for a committee in Washington. His name is Mr. Egan, and the committee was dumbfounded. But they don't pursue this. They don't exhume the body of Mr. Hoover and find out if, in fact, he was poisoned, as I understand he was. So I bring this out because when Esquire makes fun of the Third Reich theory or the Murderville theory, and then you pick up the planned fascism of Italy to be overthrown. I remember at the World Affairs Council 2 years ago, when I was able to speak there representing the people after the Cambodian invasion in the Kent State. I guess it's going on 3 years now. And I got up there and said the next country after Greece it would be put into a total state of fascism, Nazism, in Europe, you know, since World War II would be Italy. And it had to do with that coup at that time. But they're very active, and they're still murdering there, and they're murdering at home. And they will continue unless we get further with the committee in Washington. Now, the point of all this is, what can we do? The Senate Select Committee is going to have Bebe Rebozo. They're going to have John Conley as witnesses. We should have the daytime hearings. They should not have a cutoff date of February. We just got a new increase of arms of $4 billion for the war in the Middle East. There's money for every single weapon that they need. There should be money for investigating this thing. So if Baker says it's the tip of the iceberg and there's a lot more to come, we should have the televised hearing every day like we had before the summer vacation and bring out everything there is to know. And I said all along, if they had the proper witnesses and the right questions, we'd begin to exhume some of these bodies and find out what's really happening in this nation. Well, I received a letter this week from James McCord. It came to Mae Brussel and Paul Krasner and the Realist Association, dated November the 10th. Mr. James McCord, 7 Winter Court, Rockville, Maryland. And this is what James McCord wrote to Paul and me. Paul Krasner is the publisher of The Realist. This is to place Mae Brussel, Paul Krasner, and the Realist Association at 595 Broadway, New York, on legal notice that a civil suit for libel is being filed against each of you for the article by Mae Brussel on page 13 to 31 of The Realist, number 95. The statements are libels, untrue, and malicious on page 14 under number 5. 1963 assassination of President Kennedy. Pertaining to the writer and untrue statements regarding him appear elsewhere in the issue of The Realist. Your statements in that issue alleging that the 4 Miami men involved in Watergate were involved in the JFK assassination is also untrue. They were nowhere near Dallas nor in France, as you have alleged. They have witnesses as to their whereabouts on the dates alleged, and I have no involvement whatever in the JFK Kennedy assassination conspiracy. It's interesting. McCord says he had no involvement in the JFK killing. Here's a man who's worked with the CIA for 21 years, and he said he had no involvement in the conspiracy. Thank you, James McCord, for at least admitting it was a conspiracy. He said, your article is as vicious as any article could possibly be with the statements and inferences that carried that these men were a part of a conspiracy to murder a president. You may be rest assured I will carry through to completion with the libel suit on this matter. Copies of this letter are going to each of the men from Miami and their lawyer. You could have contacted me or my attorney to try and verify your story prior to publication, and you did neither. Signed, James W. McCord, Jr. It's written kind of funny. It's got New York and California, and it's not legal paper, no lawyer's paper, and he has something about incorporation departments from New York and California. And I thought I'd read on the air my answer to James McCord, Jr., which I'm mailing off this evening, dated November 26. Dear Mr. McCord, it is unfortunate that you have singled out my article in The Realist for placing a civil suit. You and I should be working together and not against each other, and this kind of divisiveness does not serve our nation as it was meant to exist. Your background and experiences are totally different than mine. The manner in which you served your country was according to your political beliefs. Whatever orders you took were to perpetuate those ideologies, even when your methods were clearly illegal and unconstitutional. It was you who was caught wearing the rubber gloves, breaking into the other person's private offices, and making their business your livelihood. The federal government has provisions for protecting this nation without the necessity of private police agencies. Your letter to Judge John Sirica, which opened up the Watergate scandal, criticized the Justice Department, the FBI, and the various persons who were, in your eyes, attempting to destroy America. You stated your fears that the intelligence agencies were going to be utilized and combined, as in Nazi Germany, to form a fascist dictatorship inside the United States. For 10 years, I have researched diligently to understand all the methods being utilized through various laws and murders to speed up the Gestapo situation. Your message, courageously expressed, coincided with my findings and reaffirmed my fears for this country. You could become America's most important hero at a time when we desperately need one if you only had the courage to tell those things that you know that are identical to Nazi Germany that are taking place today in this country. In your testimony before the Senate Select Committee, you stated openly you knew enough to burn every tree in the forest. That collected glob of spineless males that sat behind their tables never asked you what you meant or what was in your head at that time. Senator Howard Baker, as of this week, said the Senate investigation only touched the tip of the iceberg. That great investigating team, like the Warren Commission, are nothing but yellow cowards. They let their country rot from the hidden lies and the corpses that smell in every city where political murders are being passed off as accidents or heart attacks or other feeble cover stories. E. Howard Hunt hinted at all the seamy things he did for this and previous administrations, and no effort is made to set the history of the past 25 years straight so this nation can start to mature and face its past with accuracy and admission of errors made along the way. You tell me the statements made in The Realist, number 95, are libelous, untrue, and malicious. You did not like page 14, number 5, which stated in quotes, James McCord, according to Lewis Tackwood, was in Dallas the day Kennedy was shot and flown afterwards to the Caribbean, end quotes. Why haven't you chosen to sue Avon Press instead of The Realist, where this direct quotation was taken, or ask Lewis Tackwood for his evidence? Richard Nixon was also in Dallas November 22, 1963, and didn't remember that fact well enough to give the Warren Commission an accurate account of his whereabouts. The fact that you men have witnesses as to your whereabouts on the dates alleged is meaningless in terms of solving complicated military conspiracies or assassinations where hundreds of persons are involved. The Pentagon Papers illustrates how carefully Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge prepared to be out of Vietnam at the time of the coup in 1963 so he would not be associated with those events. Being present or being away from these plans has no relevance to the general nature of conspiracies. If you intend to place a libel suit against me, the purpose will be to prove that four Miami men involved in the Watergate were not involved in the John Kennedy assassination. Let me explain to you, it is very difficult for an individual like myself, working alone, much less a team of lawyers working through the courts of Washington, D.C., to meet on equal and fair terms. When a crime or series of crimes is committed by the federal government and their hired agents, they systematically destroy as much evidence as possible that would prove their own guilt. With regards to the White House logs and the missing tapes and the gemstone papers and the contents of Mr. Hunt's safe, or the filing cabinets hauled away in a van and destroyed, or the possessions in your garage that were destroyed, or the soap labels that were burned to conceal previous locations, or the lists of donors that were burned, and the lists of agents and safe houses, are all permanently destroyed, and witnesses are murdered, and threats of lives are made, and every means of proving conspiracies is turned around, leaving the burden of proof on the investigator. In the case of the John Kennedy assassination, over 35 important pieces of evidence were destroyed. Others were locked up in the National Archives for 75 years. Films have never been displayed that should be seen publicly. Hundreds of people are killed who are directly involved with that assassination. And on my other programs, I have mentioned things like the medical x-rays and autopsies of John Kennedy that were never publicly examined or even developed for the Warren Commission, the jacket of President Kennedy that was locked in the archives and has been never examined for bullet holes or bullet directions or how many bullets are in that coat, and the interior of the car that was destroyed the day that John Kennedy drove in it, and the destruction of the clothing of Governor Connally, so that the doctors claiming the wounds came from the entry from the front of the arm couldn't prove it by the fibers because the clothing were destroyed and dry cleaned. And the street signs and lampposts that were removed from Dealey Plaza, and the crucial frames from the Zapruder films that were bought up by Life magazine and never used by the Warren Commission, and the notes from the Dallas jail that Lee Harvey Oswald had dictated were all destroyed, and the original autopsy notes were burned, and Oswald's post office application that would prove that he didn't receive that rifle, that was destroyed, and the office files with the military records of Lee Harvey Oswald down in New Orleans were of Dean Andrews were destroyed. And Oswald's passport was burned by thermosfaxing the night of the assassination of John Kennedy. The federal government takes its evidence and more, and it takes the brain matter of President Kennedy that's in the archives when they discover there's a chemical content that doesn't match the weapon that allegedly Lee Harvey Oswald could have conceivably owned. The brains are thrown away. And you ask me to go to a court and prove or disprove whether or not any of you and your gang were a part of that particular conspiracy or any other conspiracy is very difficult for me to do, and you know it. With regards to the White House logs and all of the missing evidence, I have no defense or very little against the way the government tampers with the evidence. The allegations I made in my article in The Realist were that selected agents hired and paid by the federal government tamper with our electoral process. The killing of John Kennedy was removing the president because he was the winner of the 1960 election. Many researchers throughout the country are getting pieces of information together to see how many members of a team were related to any or all of these election manipulations since 1960. Your attorney, Bernard Fensterwald, should be able to tell you about my research. If my article was as vicious as any article could possibly be, as you stated, I can only say the following. To state or infer an opinion may be vicious. Killing another human being, or being part of a team that kills another human being, or protecting killers of human lives is more vicious than writing about the deaths. Protecting killers through silence is also vicious. I'm not a member of a political party or a group you can look into and check your CIA profiles. I'm sure they have about me. I do not condone communist purges, political murders, wars, assassinations, or violence of any kind, and my only purpose in researching is in the hopes to ending all wars at home and abroad and stop killing so many men so that people can be free in every country to live out their lives without hurting other people. One thing I know, which would certainly be brought into any civil suit against me, is that this federal government, under Democrats as well as Republicans, do in fact conspire and murder. I never stated that you or your four Miami men friends fired weapons or did a specific act of murdering in my research. But there was planned violence for the 1972 elections in Miami and other possible deaths that have not yet been properly exposed. I believe your awareness of what I was trying to say in my articles is too complete for you to take me as your enemy. We can't be so far apart in our thinking that we can't discuss these things together. And we can find that each of us can contribute something to this sick nation at this sad time in history that would be of importance for our children's future. and for the others who are sad and confused by so much sorrow and errors in the past. This is a time for coexistence and peace, and you want to perpetuate a battle where some minute facts are nothing compared to what you and I really know and what we could reveal as friends and patriots. Signed, Mae Brussel. To another subject, not unrelated to that at all, is an article, a radio program over WLS radio station in Chicago, Sherman Skolnick. Sherman Skolnick has access to documents that were left at his house that Dorothy Hunt contained, that were orders from the National Security Council in 1960 to kill President Kennedy when he was elected. That backs up my research that the decision to murder John Kennedy had nothing to do with the Bay of Pigs. It was because he won the election. And if this document, it does in fact exist, and it's coming out in a book written by Sherman Skolnick, it's terribly important to what I worked out and figured out, and this is a document which he claims to possess. What Sherman Skolnick says is that Dorothy Hunt had on the airplane that went down in Chicago, United Airlines Flight 553, a document to blackmail the president. And what it was, according to Skolnick, is a top-secret National Security Council memorandum bearing the signature of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, and the memorandum is dated November 22, 1960, just weeks after Kennedy was elected president and Eisenhower was filling out his nation's term as the chief executive. The memorandum says, according to Skolnick, that in the opinion of the Eisenhower National Security Council, John Kennedy's ascendancy to the office of the presidency was not in the best interests of the country. The Eisenhower National Security Council took it upon themselves at this time to declare Kennedy a threat to the national security. The private researcher, Sherman Skolnick, said that the national security document recommends, in so many words, that JFK be dealt with so that he could not hold office of the presidency. And according to Skolnick, it recommends that the Kennedy be murdered. Now, Sherman Skolnick is writing a book that's ready to come out. He has a document. He's not going to say these things and stand out on a limb. He's defenseless. He's a man who's crippled. He's in a wheelchair. He's a patriot telling you people he has this document. And that document, if it in fact exists, and I just learned of it this week, confirms again what I say was the decision the minute Kennedy won the election that he had to be killed because he was not part of the team. The article that I have here about Skolnick says the National Security Council, as established by the National Security Act of 1947, advises the president of the United States on domestic and foreign matters involving what is national security. And that does not only mean what affects us from other countries overseas, but what is happening inside our own country. The council is composed of the president, the vice president, the secretary of state and defense, and the director of the Office of Emergency Planning. And in November 1960, the date of the top secret memorandum, Richard Nixon was vice president of the United States and thus a member of the National Security Council. And if the National Security Council document is authentic, as Skolnick says it is, then Nixon was one of those who recommended that John Kennedy be murdered. I'm reading this from a newspaper article that came out this week. The National Security Council is the country's highest policy recommending body in areas related to national defense. It has a dual role. It is charged with evaluating the objectives and commitments of the United States with regards to national security and making recommendations to the president on specific policies. The Central Intelligence Agency operates under the direction of the council. Now keep in mind that James McCord, who's so offended at the things I write at the Realist, was a member of the Central Intelligence Agency for 21 years, the FBI and the CIA, as was E. Howard Hunt. These articles is the CIA, according to the National Security Council Act of 1947, which formed the agency, carries out the orders with the approval of the president. And if this document could be the key, it says, to the forces that went to head and planned the murder of John Kennedy. Did the Eisenhower National Security Council originate the plot to kill Kennedy, a plot which culminated in the Dallas coup d'etat November 22, 1963, exactly 3 years after the date of the orders? Did Eisenhower and Nixon order the CIA to murder Kennedy just weeks after the 1960 presidential elections? There's some more startling evidence. Alex Bottos is a staff investigator for Sherman Skolnick. And Alex Bottos has a article coming out, and he also appeared on radio station in Chicago, and they're doing national radio talks, and they were at the National Archives this week giving speeches in commemoration of the anniversary of the death of John Kennedy. Alex Bottos claims that Hale Boggs is still alive and that he will reappear, and that his plane was supposed to have crashed in Alaska on a flight from Anchorage to Juneau, but he has information. Boggs and another representative, Nick Bennett of Alaska, and two other men were reported that their aircraft disappeared over the southern coast of Alaska. But he has information that Boggs is alive and he's going to surface soon with startling revelations on both Watergate and on the assassination of John Kennedy, because Hale Boggs was a member of the Warren Commission, and while he signed his name to the Warren Commission, he never, according to the minutes of the meetings that I have, was never gung-ho and really went along with the findings or the conclusions or went for, he signed his name to it, but he asked some provocative questions at the meetings, and he had a lot of doubts in his mind. And Alex Bottos claimed that this story will be elaborated soon, and that the flight 553 that brought Dorothy Hunt down had with it a 1,200-page document, and that Sherman Skolnick has a copy of this, the only copy of the official crash report. There were 1,200 pages of this that don't even mention the document that he has a copy of, which has to do with this National Security Council order. So there's a lot going on in Washington, and as this gets heavier, the question comes up, what will Richard Nixon do? And are they waiting for Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission, to be confirmed? Nixon will resign. And this week, in the interim of, I was away 1 week, there were articles of Jack Anderson again. Is there going to be a military takeover? Is there going to be a coup d'etat in the White House? How close are we to it? When I said that a year and a half ago, it sounded ridiculous, but that subject is coming up. Now, I did want to go at length about an experience I had in Dayton, Ohio. I think I met the second Oswald. There were two Oswalds, two Lee Harvey Oswalds. And I think I met one of them who was anxious to meet me. I've been in contact with him, never knew who he was, sending me letters and printed messages and telephone messages. But and there are many, many instances that we'll go over next week on proof that there were two Lee Harvey Oswalds. But a gentleman came up to me in Dayton, Ohio, when I was through speaking, and met me in the street as I was walking back to where I was staying. And he took me by surprise and said, "Do you know who I am?" And I recognized his voice, and I looked at him, and I said, "You're Lee Harvey Oswald." And he said, "A lot of people tell me I am." And then when I went to the airport leaving Dayton, I picked up a little newspaper called the National Tattler, and one of the articles in there was an article by John McConnell to the effect that in the grave where Lee Harvey Oswald is supposed to be buried is nothing but a sack of potatoes. And I have the minutes of the Warren Commission where the first meeting they had to decide what to do with what was ever in that grave because the nation couldn't stand another shot. So for next time, next week, we're going to talk about my experience in Dayton, Ohio, and maybe the second Oswald is alive. He's very anxious for me to continue the radio talks and tell the truth, and he's very supportive of what I'm doing, and I feel confident this could be one of the operatives that was involved in Dallas. Time is 1 minute over. I'm sorry. I'll see you next week.